Okay, so it wasn't hard for me to stand out in high school. No. I was a black kid with a blonde jerry curl, wearing a top hat, preaching about the end of days. They didn't have to like me. They knew who I was. I told anyone who would listen that it didn't matter what they thought about what I did, but the swagger, the hair, the stroll, the hat, the persona, my strange, strange persona, all the stuff that set me apart was calibrated to what they thought, or what I thought they thought. Because really, just like everyone else, the crazy kid just wanted to fit in. I knew there had to be something I could do, something I could wear, something I could say, so that they would like me. And I could be part of a group, any group, except for my group of one. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Standouts.
Standouts.
Amazing stories from real people standing out from the crowd, whether they want to or not. My name is Glenn Washington. Buckle up, because you're listening to Snap Judgment.
Snap Judgment.
You know that kids can be cruel. You know this. And my feeling is that most of the time, they learned it somewhere else. Snap Judgment, Stephanie Fu spoke to Sarah about standing out.
Aphrodite was a blonde. The ideal woman was, in the summer of 76, tanned with gleaming white teeth and flipped out hair. She was an angel.
The Farrah Fawcett picture in the red bathing suit was the poster that all the boys had. She was the female icon. I would study that poster of her. I knew that this was a female and that I wasn't that.
Nobody could mistake Sarah for a goddess. She was 16 and she was still flat-chested. No hips, no butt, no period.
I would stuff athletic socks in a bra that was too big for me. And then one day in basketball practice, on the other end of the court, I saw a sock. The girls saw it. They called me Tank. The next day, one of the girls said, "Susie, have you got a tissue?" "Tank, do you have a tissue?" "No, I don't have any tissues." "Check your bra, Tank." Horrified. Horrified. Horrified.
But that wasn't the end of it. Things got worse as Sarah got taller and taller, 6'3", and fitting in became impossible.
I looked more like I belonged on the defensive line of the high school football team.
When she was 16, Sarah's parents finally became concerned about her lack of development, and they took her to see some doctors.
They said that I'm genetically female.
But Sarah had gonadal dysgenesis. Instead of ovaries, she had gonadal streaks, lumps of undeveloped tissue inside her that would become cancerous. They scheduled a surgery to remove the lumps and to see whether she had female sexual organs or whether they'd have to construct them within her.
I was so ashamed that something about my gender and my genitalia was wrong.
The last thing she hoped when they put her to sleep was that she would wake up normal.
And the first thing my mom whispered into my ear was, "You're a girl and you don't have to have any more surgeries."
And her father came up and told her,
"You're all girl. You're 100% girl."
She went on estrogen and developed breasts, but her body never looked quite like the other girls. She realized that she would never be a regular woman. And she was afraid that because of that, nobody would ever love her.
I felt like that was God saying, "You thought maybe you could escape and actually have a life and have children and be normal? No way, honey. I will squash you like a bug anytime you think you're going to have any happiness."
But then came David.
I very briefly was singing with a band, and David was friends with some of the bandmates. I was singing me and Bobby McGee, Janis Joplin, and there weren't enough microphones, and I offered to share my microphone with this cute guy. He put his hand around my hip, I put my hand around his hip, and we swayed to the music, and David and I just talked and talked. It didn't matter what he was saying, I thought he was hot.
At first, Sarah couldn't believe he was really into her.
And I kept wondering, he doesn't seem to notice that I'm big, he doesn't seem to notice that I'm overweight, he just seems to really like me. He is either so highly evolved that he's not seeing the imperfections of the packaging, or he's a liar. And so we're in Sausalito, and we're hugging and kissing in the street, and some construction workers yell, "Get a room, fellas." I was mortified, because I thought, now David's going to really notice how different I look. And he just turned and laughed and said, "You think she's a guy? You're idiots."
David made Sarah feel like a woman. Well, a loud, brash, unladylike interpretation of a woman anyway. He made her feel like herself. And so, 2 years later, she's the one who proposed.
I had a pendant made that had, "Will you marry me, David?" written on one side. I got down on one knee in the hot tub and gave him the necklace. And he just said, "Yes, of course."
Sarah and David found a priest, drove to Santa Cruz, and on a grassy knoll by the sea, they eloped. And they lived in wedded bliss for almost 2 decades. La-da-da-da, me and Bob Dylan. Last year, 19 years into their marriage, Sarah happened to be surfing the web. She'd always accepted the doctor's diagnosis, but she was curious and decided to Google her condition. And that's when she discovered something called Swire syndrome. Remember when Sarah's father told her that she was 100% girl? Well, he wasn't telling 100% of the truth. Though Sarah's body is physically female, she has XY chromosomes.
I will squash you like a bug.
Male chromosomes. After they diagnosed her, the doctors approached her father and said, "If you want, we can make her a 3-inch penis." Obviously, he turned them down, but nobody ever asked Sarah.
Here I am, genetically male. And I had never thought, until last year, I had never even considered the idea that I hadn't been told the complete truth. I thought I knew it all, my whole story.
This explained everything. The reason why Sarah never felt like a woman is that she never was one. She wasn't a female with tomboyish traits. She is genetically male with female traits.
I identify as an intersex human being. I live in this middle ground, and this middle ground ain't a bad place to be.
This new person is still Sarah. She was happy with the person she'd cultivated over the past 20 years. Sarah could never have been an angel, but Hermaphroditus was a god. But how would David react to Sarah's new identity? What would you do if your wife of 20 years came out to you as genetically male?
My wife is named Sarah. She's tall, strong, beautiful. She's got breasts. She's got genitalia. She's female. And that's just the way I treat it. It's that simple for me. And when all this came up last year, my take on it was, okay, so now you know a little more details than you did before. But it doesn't change who you are. It couldn't.
Feeling good was easy, boy, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Ooh, good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
If I had been an emotionally capable 17-year-old, I might have opted to go the male direction. I think I might have opted to keep my genitalia just as it is now, take testosterone, have a beard, and someone out there will love me. And I think David would have.
I would have too.
If David had come along in 1988 and found that Sarah living as Sam, David would have fallen in love with that person.
Do you really think that?
You know, I'd like to think so, and I gotta tell you, ain't nobody ever gonna know.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for sharing your story with a snap. That piece was produced by Stephanie Fu.
Dimulakan dengan bismillah, disudahi dengan alhamdulillah.
Now here's the rule, and it's not even really that hard. When you're in a Muslim country, never, ever, never, 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 ever, never, ever disrespect the Prophet. You just don't do it. And you got some friends, they want to go out and clown, say, hey, let's go over here, do this and that. You say, no. And so I was enjoying myself working in Malaysia. It's a beautiful country, beautiful people. I was sad to have to leave. Everybody told me, everybody said, before you go home, you've got to go see the National Mosque. You've got to see the mosque. I took a bus. I got off. I bought a robe and I walked up to the building. A guard checked me out, looked me up and down. Everything's cool. Then he bent down and said, no pictures, before pointing me inside the mosque. And the thing was, everybody was right. The first step inside was heart-stopping. Islamic arches soared stories into the sky. Sunshine bounced off of blue-tiled frescoes. And the heart of the mosque, the center, reserved for the faithful at prayer, was bathed in reflected green sunlight. It felt holy, set apart. And everywhere there were signs saying no pictures to protect the prayerful. And I just felt lucky, just lucky to be there. The arches, the silence, the dance of green and blue, and it was just me by myself to enjoy it. Then the heavy steps, the smacking of lips, and oh, Casper, this is beautiful, beautiful. I'm in a mosque on the other side of the world, and still Team Midwest has tracked me down. Well, Nancy, I'm just going to get my camera and see if I can take just the one picture, just the one. Casper, you really should. Casper reaches inside his day bag, grabs his camera, brings it up to his eyes for the shot, and I tried. I did try, but before I could get the words out of my mouth, several turban giants appeared. They're running full stride, these serious uniform brothers. They wrap Casper and Nancy away like Tupperware, hands over hollering miles, camera snatched off the ground, nobody around, done before it even got started. I'm wondering, did that even happen? Silence. Like before the invasion. Now, did I shed a tear for the unfortunate fate of my countrymen? I did not. I did not. Embarrassing me. Didn't they know the rule? And looking back, it might have been right there, and my contempt was born the seed of my own catastrophe. Just a few hours later, a couple of my boys were giving me the traditional expat send-off at the local watering hole. When we finally left the bar, the sun was back in the sky, and they insisted on taking me to the airport themselves. Cool, cool. Along the way, we pulled over into a rest area. Now, in the developing world, you never know what a restroom is going to look like. It could be something out of the Four Seasons, or it could be a hole in a plank. You never know. We walked into the building, and immediately we saw a door for men and a door for women. So far, so good. We opened the men's door, and there's a large trough of water. And really, this is better than we expected. I let the German and the Englishman fight each other for ground, and I waited my turn in the hall. And as I stood there, waiting, the caretaker of the building approached me. He smiled. I smiled back. Toilet? Yeah, toilet. The man pointed down the hall. He pointed way down the hall. And suddenly, I realized that I was going to perish in a dark prison. No one would ever see me again because I had gotten cocky. I had broken the one rule. You see, I wasn't waiting outside a toilet at all, no.
The faithful in Islam on long journeys often stop along the road to clean themselves in water before kneeling in prayer to Allah. And water. The same water my friends were urinating in. Maybe I blinked, maybe my arm twitched, but the caretaker got suspicious and was sniffing, tore the door aside, and saw the full abomination with his own eyes. Run! No questions, no jokes, fools ran, pants flapping. The alarm was blaring, the caretaker was screaming. I knew we were going to die. I floored the car and hoped that everybody that needed to be was inside the ride, because there was no going back. We could never go back there. It was later when I saw Nancy and Casper at the airport bar. They didn't recognize me, and I asked if I could buy them a drink. Sure, Nancy said, if I can buy you one. Gin and tonics all around. We talked about Ohio State versus Michigan football, and then the what brings you to Malaysia? Oh, said Nancy, we're going everywhere we can while Casper can still see it. Casper grew on it. Nothing too crazy, he said. My eyes just aren't what they used to be. I can't see distance very well anymore, so I take pictures. I print them out. I get to see my vacation for the first time sitting on my couch back home. Wow. Really? Yeah, in fact, let me get a picture of you right now. I leaned in next to Nancy. I looked directly at the camera. And I smiled just as broadly as I could.
Now then, when Snap Judgment, the standout episode, continues, we solve an urban mystery written in stone. And Superman is about to finally meet his match. It's all coming up next. Snap Judgment. Stay tuned. Back to Snap Judgment, the standout episode. Today, we're exploring people who have a secret. You see, our next story is about a guy determined to stand out from the crowd, but he still doesn't want you to even know who he is. Delphine Vigil has the story.
I first found Nico by staring at the sidewalks, and I did that because I was recently laid off from my job at the Chronicle. One of my favorite things was always to kind of get lost in San Francisco and stare at things that I normally might have looked past, and then I saw his name written in the sidewalk, Nico, and I thought it was interesting. And then a block later, I found his name again, Nico. I turned a corner through Chinatown into North Beach, and I found another Nico. One. You know, I would find them not just in North Beach, but Chinatown, Russian Hill, Telegraph Hill. They would be references to the street name, like Nico on Filbert or Nico on 9th, Nico downtown. And then the personality of me was really coy. It was like, Nico is here, Nico gets it all. What was interesting is the order in which I found them was sometimes kind of synchronistic and uncanny. I think I was late for a job interview, and so I'd say, man, I'm getting compulsive about this. And then I'd look down and say, Nico, concrete compulsive. And I remember once I was just saying to myself, damn, Nico is everywhere. And then I looked down and it said, Nico is everywhere. I certainly felt close to him in the sense that, like, I know, I felt like a duty. And I remember thinking that, this is my duty to write this story. And then coincidentally, I'd run across a clue that said, Nico on duty. So whether I liked it or not, I felt like I was getting close to him. I made a lot of presumptions, and that was what kind of what you had to do to sort of profile who would do this. First of all, I knew it was a guy, because it didn't seem like something a girl would do. And I figured he didn't have a father in the picture. Question was, how could he do this without anybody finding out and saying, hey, don't do this anymore? And these clues would go from 1967 to, I think, about around 99, 98. Because I saw the date 1967, I figured, well, he must have been about, I don't know, 12 years old. In some ways, I got to watch him grow up because I felt like his personality kind of got a little more bolder through the years. Earlier stuff may just say Nico. And later on, he would call himself Nico Concrete Artist. The most fascinating clue I'd ever come across in the sidewalks was a question.
Who is Nico? Just why does he?
And it was, the rest of the question was cut off by a new section of sidewalk. You know, I wanted to know, is this guy alive? Why did he do it? But nobody, I mean, it was obvious that I was doing something weird. I took pictures of all of these things. So anybody taking photograph of, you know, something on the sidewalk, people would always kind of look through the corner of their eye, what's that guy doing, you know? It was the first time I'd ever felt like I was the one paying attention in class. And it was like, you know, doesn't anybody else care? So I thought for a minute, well, maybe he worked for concrete contractors. And so I would run into the workers who were there on the job and ask them, sometimes right as they were actually about to tear out an eco from the sidewalk. And they would be like, what, you know, I got to get to work, kid. My image of him was based on a borrowed face because I went to high school with a guy named Nico. He was a tough kid. He was a tough city kid. Went to juvenile hall and all that sort of thing. And so I had pictured this Nico as kind of being the sort of artful dodger of San Francisco. I figured he went to school in the neighborhood, so I went to the high school, Galileo, and I went to Francisco Middle School. And so I would start photocopying yearbook pictures from the 60s and 70s. And I would base this on guys who looked like they just had that kind of James Dean look in their eye. It was by the North Beach Playground. I believe it was rainy day, and rainy days were always the best days to read the concrete because it washed away a lot of the dirt and you could read things that on other days you probably couldn't see. And I saw this etching that was the longest that I'd ever seen. It took up an entire sidewalk block. It was like a paragraph. And at first I thought, no, it can't be him. I think it said,
America's a great country, built by the white man, owned by the Jew, ruined by the...
And then the first word began with an N, but I can't actually say for sure. I mean, I can presume what it said, and you probably can too, but that those letters were actually washed away from foot traffic. And then I'd found quite a few others, and it was, you know, we're talking 10, 15, 20, and in some cases right by Nico, in other cases directly below. And as far as I could tell from the handwriting, it was Nico. I didn't want to believe it, because it didn't go with, you know, what I identified with. I mean, to some extent, I wanted to identify as the kind of loner kid in the city, too. And this happened right before I finally found him. As far as, like, the Sherlock Holmes work, it all came together. Kind of felt more like Sam Spade. By that point, 3 years into it, I had spoken to the story to quite a bit of people and asked, if you ever hear anything about it, let me know. And one of those finally came through, and someone said that they had met him. And then she called me back and remembered it, and then that's how I found him.
Who knows who Nico is? A handful of people?
My godfather, my sister, my best friend.
How did you never get caught?
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
It's the oldest trick in the book, or pretend like you dropped something.
How many do you think you've done?
A thousand.
A thousand, huh?
I'm just picking 1,000 out of the air.
At least 1,000.
At least 1,000, yeah. My thoughts were that if I do this really deep and do it right, this stuff will last way into the future, and it'll be like the concrete will be all washed away with the pebbles poking up. My name will still be there.
How far in the future were you visualizing this lasting?
Oh, after I was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just figured if I do it, maybe 5,000, maybe one, you know, 100 years, you know, maybe there'll be one or two left.
It's kind of like any story you get into when you have a hunch about it. A lot of it was very close to what I had imagined, and a lot of it was completely different. He did have a very artful dodger lifestyle. His father was out of the picture, and he had a very bohemian upbringing, with kind of like a real carefree parenting style from his mother, who was an artist and was friends with musicians. And he was just this kind of kid who was sort of, in some ways, forgotten.
I pictured Nico as being kind of tough and maybe out on his own, beating other kids up.
I wasn't tough. I never beat anybody.
Well, this is where I'm wrong in a lot of things. And that's the thing that I've learned, that I've been wrong. And that's kind of where I'm at. I mean, I would see a ban all non-white immigration over by the Stockton Tunnel, and then I'd see it over on Russian Hill. There's how about white race consciousness, keep America white. I mean, about 12 or 13 of them, in the same block of cement, I'd also saw the name Nico.
Let's jump ahead. You probably want to know, did I write that stuff?
Well, I'll be straight up honest with you. I think you did.
That would be Billy that wrote that. That really long, complicated...
Uh-huh.
Do you know how much effort it would take to write that in wet concrete?
Who else would know?
Man, I get in there. I was in there. I was bending down, tying my shoe, as all people saw, and I was out of there.
I can pick out about 15 to 20 that seemed to me would be the same guy who did Nico, who would be you. But if I'm wrong...
Here's the deal, look. Okay. When I was a kid growing up in the city...
Yeah.
I'm talking a little kid. On Sunday, we would go to a march in Oakland for civil rights, for a peace march. On Monday, I'd go to school, and I'd get the kicked out of me by the very people that we were out putatively trying to help. I mean, this sounds absurd now, but it was all in my mind. It was all put together. What I did was I thought, what is the one thing I can do that will really bug my mother and her friends? Well, if you get right down to it, how does a boring suburban kid rebel against their parents? They go to the opposite extreme of what the parents believe in, right?
This is...
How does a kid that's being like raised by a bunch of beatnik peace activists, civil rights marchers, rebel against their parents?
Sure.
But I repent.
Totally, I understand.
I'm a hardcore green activist now, man.
Yeah.
Have some more cheese, man.
Thanks.
We've got to finish this up. It's been sitting out.
Sure.
What are you going to write, man? You told me you were going to write this thing about Nico. You
know? I am writing about Nico. And that's why I'm trying to figure out who is Nico, why he does it. And I think I feel like I found out. I don't think that you technically wrote all these things. I think Nico did. And I think there's a difference between you and Nico, and I think Nico is pretty much is gone.
I've not written my name, but I've written his name in wet concrete. In fact, that was the first line I wrote for the story. It was in the sidewalk. Walk up Montgomery Street toward the Union Street steps and make a right at Green Street, and right there, unless someone's double parked on top of it, it should still say, I found Nico.
Big thanks to Delphine Vigil for taking us mystery solving with him. If you want to see Delphine's beautiful art book that inspired this piece, we'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece, it was produced by Stephanie Fu. Okay, so Jeff and his girlfriend were going on vacation, Mexico. And that, of course, is all well and good. But Jeff has a different notion of vacation than your neighbors booking their passage on the Carnival Cruise Line.
Never spent more than a couple dollars a night. I felt like that was my mission, to sort of just be real.
Jeff demands that he experience what the local people experience, that he eat what the local people eat, that he feel what the local people feel.
We were seriously roughing it.
So lest they be mistaken for those loud, pasty people haggling for trinkets, Jeff led his girlfriend far away from everywhere and everything to an island off the Yucatan Peninsula with a wonderful, secluded, deserted beach. It was beautiful. Nobody around. It was so far off the beaten path, though, that it was missing one crucial thing. Food.
We didn't really have a lot of supplies. There wasn't like a market or anything there. We were kind of scrounging ourselves and trying to collect mussels and stuff.
See, paradise with no food is no paradise at all. Then they meet a savior.
This young kid came up to us, and we started talking to him, and it turns out that he was sort of subsisting by fishing, and he would give us some of that.
He showed them how to hunt for game.
I remember standing there with him, we were just talking. He catches something out of the corner of his eye, and he kind of just slyly reaches down and grabs a rock, and he's still talking to me. He doesn't even stop his conversation. And he throws a bullet about 25 feet away at this pile of rocks. And the next thing I know, I see an iguana flying up in the air, like 4 feet, doing cartwheels after it'd been struck in the head, and then land down another meal.
The last just shot was not as true as the little boy's. Their bellies remained empty.
I was really flipping out.
Then a problem arose on the horizon.
One night, we were sitting on this hill and watching the sunset, and I began to notice these lights getting slightly bigger on the water.
First a speck, then a thing, then a monstrosity growing closer, ever closer.
I started to realize that it was a tourist boat.
They were coming.
Right to where I was.
As if they owned the place. A bloated, showy tourist boat with the unmitigated gall to unload right down the beach from Camp Almost Paradise.
These are the people that I really have wanted nothing to do with on my entire trip.
And being a tourist boat, it did what tourist boats do. It threw a tiki party.
Hi, baby!
Damn them to hell! Suspicious. They stayed on the periphery that night, on the outside looking in. But the next night,
I sat out again to watch the sunset, and sure enough, there come the lights again. And there's the boat, and there's the party on the beach, and I start thinking, we need to take advantage of this.
Hello, shorty, you ready to party?
We clean up as best we can.
Okay.
You know, I still had a razor. I think I probably shaved dry. And I put on, you know, the best shirt I had and strolled on over to the crew's beach party. And this guy in a white jacket comes up to me, and I'm thinking, oh, God, you know, they're going to tell us to walk away. He holds out a tray full of drinks, and he offers a beer, tequila. They're barbecuing whole barracuda. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had barbecued barracuda, but after sitting on an island like eating iguana,
it's so delicious.
So we just stuffed ourselves, man.
They eat their fill and step back, back into the shadows. The days of hunting lizard are fading in their memory already.
The next night, we get cleaned up way in advance. We're not worrying about lunch. We're not worrying about dinner. I'm building up an appetite.
So, there's the sunset. There's the lights.
There's the boat. Here we go.
They stroll over. Great cruise. Hey, Jack, how's Cindy? Sure, I'll have a beer.
You know, you mix in.
You better believe you mix in. One night turns to two, three become four. It's vacation, baby.
We would spend the day snorkeling and just relaxing, and there was not a worry in your mind about sort of filling your belly. It's Pavlov's dog, you know. The sun starts to set and you're just drooling.
Ring the bell. Ding, ding, ding.
It was a Sunday, and we were out running around all day and just working up a really big appetite.
There's the sunset. Right on.
And there was no lights appearing. And we thought, well, it must be just a little delayed tonight.
But the boat never came.
We sat on that hill for about 2.5 hours, refusing to believe that the boat wasn't coming and that we had nothing to eat.
Sure. It's gonna come. It's gonna come, right? It's gonna come back. Jeff has to make a choice. He's jonesing for that boat. But then He looks at himself. What has he become? What is he? A tourist. Waiting for his cocktail with a little umbrella sticking out. No.
I think at that point, I sort of realized how dependent we were. And so the next day we packed up and left the island and moved on.
Keep it real, Jeff. Keep it real.
We sincerely hope that you are eating well. That piece was produced by Roman Mars and Sarah Jesse. Now, when Snap Judgment, the standout episode, returns, the Man of Steel meets his match, and the young girl fights the power in the only way she knows how. All this and more when Snap Judgment continues. Stay tuned. Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the standout episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're exploring stories from people who, for one reason or another, have set themselves apart from the crowd. And no one has set herself apart from the crowd like Snap Judgment's Rebecca Hertz.
My junior year in high school, I was a militant feminist. I was a riot girl.
Suck my left one!
It was the early 90s. I wanted to get away from all men, and I wanted to get as far away from home as I possibly could. I wanted to go to Barnard, the Women's College of Columbia University in New York City. Getting into that school was going to be my ticket out. My grades were great, and I knew I had to keep them that way. So I took chemistry my junior year. I was getting straight A's. It was an arts high school. So for the final, the chem teacher, Mr. Hutchinson, decided to do something creative. Instead of a final, everybody had to write a 10-page paper and give an oral report on something scientific. Society's problem with something. Anything. Now, I had spent the year reading the seminal texts of early feminism, and I had just finished reading Alice Walker's book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, which is a novel about female genital mutilation in Africa. And I knew a lot of girls and boys in school who were sexually active but didn't know what a clitoris was. I knew what my report would be. Everybody else's report sucked. I got up in front of the class and announced my report. Society's problem with the vagina.
Vagina.
I had done a ton of research. I explained modern gynecology and obstetrics, episiotomies, how in some traditions women were required to hold up a bloody sheet on the wedding night, and if they didn't bleed, well, they were killed. Also, the girls and boys in the class finally learned what and where was the clitoris. They all loved it, but not Mr. Hutchinson. He never looked up at me, not even once. The next week, he told me he was going to fail me. I hadn't gotten permission to do a report on that subject. So he was within his rights. An F? I'd never gotten an F before. It was so unfair. This teacher had the power to destroy my dreams of escaping to college. My life was ruined. We were walking across campus to Chem Lab, and all the kids in my class spontaneously confronted Mr. Hutchinson.
You can't fail her.
She gave the best report, by far.
It was so well-researched.
It was engaging.
Hello, we actually learned something. We'll go to the principal.
So I got an A-, and after writing 10 drafts of a normal, boring college application essay, I ended up telling this story instead. And that's how I got into college. The hard way. The next year, someone did a report on the penis. Oh, poor Mr. Hutchinson. So uncomfortable.
We don't need you. We don't need you.
Don't need you.
Rebecca Hertz, thank you so much for sharing your story on The Snap. Music for that piece was provided by the group Bikini Kill. Now, we like the story so much that we made a movie about it. It's on our website right now. Go check it out. Snapjudgment.org. Rule number one. Whatever it is you do, always look good doing it. See, now my quantum drive, the lithium core, dimension jumping rocket ship, does not just go fast. It's sharp, baby. Yes, that is a new chrome alloy, and no, it is not available in stores. Recognize. And please understand, if they had made the big fuss about how unbreakable the new security system was, I wouldn't even have bothered. Check the tape. I sat there for 45 minutes, big sack full of jewels in my lap, before I finally pulled the alarm my damn self. That's when the fun started. I hopped in my rocket ship and tore through the middle of downtown Metropolis, making up all kinds of commotion. Sirens, helicopters, police lights. I'm having a ball. Then here he comes. Superman. And right on cue, the ladies start screaming, "Oh, Superman, 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 so brave." It is not brave to go in a burning building when you do not burn. It ain't brave to get shot when you don't feel bullets. Superman, nothing stops him. Nothing. Kryptonite, please. I think he started that nonsense. I tried everything. Kryptonite rays, kryptonite missiles. Once, I had the fool locked in a kryptonite coffin. Oh, it hurts. Kryptonite, kryptonite. Then he broke out and started tearing up my secret lab. It just never stops. Then, he's got the nerve to put on some glasses and suddenly he's incognito. Like I'm stupid. I even called him out at the club. "What's up, Superman? How you doing, Superman?" "Clark, steady looking all around all corny like I must be talking to somebody else. Excuse me? What's going on here?" "Whatever, man." And no, this had nothing to do with Lois Lane. You want to know what this is about? You want to know what this beef is about? One thing and one thing only. Jungle fever. Superman had it bad. Call me what you want to, but Clark Kent was up in Legends Nightclub 7 nights a week chasing the chocolate goodness. And I'm not hating, I understand. But one night, I'm ordering my Hennessy, turn around, and there he is talking to Sheila, my Sheila. And I'm like, "Oh, hell to the no." But I'm supposed to step to the Man of Steel? And on top of everything else, Superman's got that mind control. How else Sheila gonna get up in front of everybody in the club and walk out with Clark Kent? Explain me that. She was with me. She came there with me. So, yeah, I stalked him. I followed him. I know him better than his mama, and I don't know him at all. He's weird. Like, he's reading the words that come out of his mouth. For a while, I thought he was a robot, 'cause everybody breaks character sometimes, but not Superman.
trailing with my special Seeing Everywhere machine. He knew I was watching the whole time and he didn't care. Why should he? Do you know what Superman does in his apartment by himself? Huh? Nothing. Just sits there. Doesn't turn on the TV, doesn't eat cereal, doesn't watch porn. He does nothing but sit there and look stupid. I had to take him out. I tried to take him out. I couldn't take him out. At first, if you don't succeed, try again and again and again. And every time, he's off flying me back to jail, steady making pronouncements about fighting evil. I am nobody's evil. I just don't think we should be letting aliens from outer space roll up in here with our women. That's why I said it, our women. Now, I'm evil, please. My name is Darnell, and what I am is a student of the game. The rules clearly state when the big dog is up in your way, accept your place, son. Or you go get you some more juice. I needed power. Crazy power. Power like the sun. I started looking, and my brand new secret laboratory, turns out there are dimensions between the dimensions. And dimensions between that. The deeper you dig, the stronger the force, the stronger the power. All this technology, and in the end, I didn't just find power. I found God. And I put him in a gun. At least, I think it's God, or maybe it's the devil. It's really simple, though. At the end of the universe, the end of time, the end of everything, it is going to ask you what matters. No more waiting eons for your personal judgment day. My little shooter sends you there with a quickness. And you can't lie. You can't lie. God will have her answer. So anyway, Superman was hovering in front of my chrome grill rocket ship. I went on ahead and fired my tractor beam. Useless. Superman ripped the hatch off my ship like it was wrapping paper. Aight, you got me. Stop tearing up my ride. Your reign of terror has come to an end. The crowd cheered. Superman's gaze stayed fixed into the distance as he flew me off to prison. I even gave him a couple minutes. Hey, Clark. He didn't turn his head, didn't look at me. I was not worth the effort to him. Hey, Clark, I've got a present for you. I shot God right between his eyes. It was instantaneous. I saw Superman at the end of the universe. Then came the question. Will you give your life to save this world? Or will you live as a hero, knowing the earth is doomed? Tough one, Clark. Lay down your life like a new Jesus, or keep up with this fake hero act. Superman bowed his head and answered instantly, softly, "Hero." Ah, finally, at long last, Super Duper Man was off script. Then we were back in the sky, Superman still flying me off to jail. The air was warm, salty, delicious. I spoke in a little voice, because I know he's got that super hearing. Clark. Clark, I heard you, Clark. I heard you sell us out. Nothing. Nothing, no reaction at all. Then he blinked. Just a blink. And everything changed. We sped towards the ground. I didn't scream because I couldn't scream. I couldn't inhale. We landed. Soft. Like a swan kissing the water. He released me. His eyes shone. His mouth hung open in shock. Then Superman shrieked. The air burned. Yeah. He looked at me then. Yeah.
for the first time ever, he looked at me then. I spit in his face. It ran down his cheek and his eye. He shot up into the air, speeding toward the sun. See, life hurts. We all have hard choices to make. I had my own decision in front of the light. But that, see, that's a whole other story. Thank you so much, Dr. Evil. We'll certainly be hearing more from your secret location in upcoming episodes of The Snap. Dr. Evil was aided and abetted by Snap Judgment's Mark Ristich. Now, if you missed any Snap goodness, do not fear. It is that time. There's plenty more where this came from. Full episodes, the podcast, pictures, stuff, available right now at snapjudgment.org. On Facebook, on Twitter, tweet, we're all there. Snap Judgment was produced by myself and the standout all-star radio dream team. Please put your hands together for the Uber producer, Coach Mark Ristich. Power forward, Pat Lasidi Miller. Point guard, Anna Dunks-a-Lot Sussman. Clogging up the center is Stephanie Fu. Our small forward is Julia DeWitt. Renzo, the enforcer, Gorio. Nick Vanderkolk once played for the Harlem Globetrotters. And Will Urbina hates the instant replay. You know that person that thinks their vintage members only jacket is so dope they have to wear it every single day, even when it's 102 degrees outside? Don't make fun. That's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting trying to keep up with the hipsters. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. You know, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could refuse to listen to music. You could reject offers of dancing in a nightclub establishment. You could cover your ears with soundproof woolen muffs to block out any temptation, but you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.